on this week's anthology.
In the beginning, when the world was young, there were a great many thoughts, but no such thing as a truth. Man made the truths himself, and each truth was a composite of a great many vague thoughts.
And now he could not sleep and wondered why he had thought of it. Something quick was moving the earth.
To end is to begin, an anthology of fiction and poetry on writers, writing, and exploring the borders of the self.
Discover.
Imagine.
Relate.
Engage. Escape.
Join the Cricket's Bone Caravan audio troupe for a journey of literary discovery, classic and contemporary writing, from voices that dare you to listen. This is Heather Perry. In this episode, short fiction by Sherwood Anderson and Juna Barnes, and poems to start us on our way.
When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and look upon myself and curse my fate.
Is there a sound?
There is a forest.
What is the world?
The word
is wilderness.
What is the answer?
The answer is the world.
What is the beginning?
A beginning is happiness.
What is the end?
No one lives there now.
What is the beginning?
The beginning is light.
What makes happiness?
Nothing.
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 What makes an ending?
What does not?
What is her skin?
Her skin is composed of strange clothing and clouds of butterflies, of events and odors, of the rose fingers of dawn, transparent suns of full daylight, blue loves of dusk, and nightfish with huge eyes.
Max Walter Schwanberry.
What makes a question?
Birds in the evening.
When do birds die?
When it is complete.
What makes a world?
The leaves shimmer in the wind. They reverberate with small heat and large wind, and they cannot be counted.
What is music?
A man lives there with his sister. They count the buses passing their window, and they count the small winged insects which die on that windowsill.
Who is happy?
Nothing is necessary. Everything that is, is.
When does it end?
A green delight the wounded mind endears after the hustling world is broken off.
John Clare?
What is the beginning?
The completion.
How does it complicate?
In that it dazzles. When does it matter?
Blue loaves of dusk.
Who perishes?
Who listens?
There will be prizes.
What is a child?
Blue lives of dusk.
Where does dust come from?
From tropical skies.
When is it over?
Into childhood, into fantasy, through the streets of New York, through tropical skies, into the receiving trays the balls come to rest, releasing prizes.
Joseph Cornell.
What does a child do?
Listens with his body, with her body.
When does it end?
Listens with the hands.
Does it end?
The hands, which are small and wide.
Where do children come from?
White pebbles.
Who suffers?
No one returns from there.
Who suffers?
There was once a small forest with a path of white pebbles and a tame group of frights and follies. Whoever entered knew the path would carry them to the other side, but that it would be scary and fun at the same time. No one who entered was ever seen again.
Is there a sound?
There is a forest.
Who listens?
The large lady with the small dog. She leans into the neighbor's yard to sniff the hydrangea once more, hoping this time it will have an odor, a sweetness which she feels such a desperate need for. She is near despair. She is thinking of killing herself. Except who would care for her, the dog? Who could know what he feels, what he needs, what his smelly bed in the corner actually means to him?
What matters?
There is a forest.
Who listens?
Another theory of the origin of the universe holds that matter is a way of thinking. A little like love, actually, if you think of it that way.
What matters?
There is a forest.
What is the word?
There is a color, and no one knows what to do with it. We would be happier without it is one theory. We are irresponsible and full of angers like colors.
What does the child think?
The child.
What does the child think?
Happiness.
What child?
A word is a small part of itself. It is round at times, and it satisfies only itself.
Does it answer?
It does not.
What is pain?
What is pain?
A small island, or perhaps it is a large island. The adjective is merely relative and a convenience. There are a few inhabitants, one actually ever at a time, and the sky's red would perhaps be beautiful if there were another, even a single other inhabitant, alas.
What is pain?
A man turns and locks his door with exactly the same small dance of hands every morning at the same hour and pockets the key followed by a pat of the pocket with the hand which just locked the door. Unknown to him, it is his life. It is the center and source of what he calls his life. It makes him what he is, happy to call happy.
Who suffers?
Oh, it is true there are causes of cruelty. It is that kind of world.
What is geometry?
It is how we know and what.
What is the purpose of memory?
Blue lines of dust.
What is the cat when she yawns?
What is dust?
Does the child suffer?
The child is suffering.
Is the child cruel?
The child crushes the world at will. The child destroys with angelic decorum. The child bleeds into his own drinking water and smiles to see color, a demon and delirium. The child is born knowing and screaming, and there is pain in his fist when he enters, and there is pain as if the atoms which whirl mad in their completeness were tiny childbirths. And it is the cruelty of children which presses upon the innocent earth, and coal turns to diamond.
What is to perish?
What is to choose?
What is to crush?
Trouble Deaf Heaven by Ben Ramke appears in his 2001 book, Airs, Waters, Places, published by University of Iowa Press. The poem takes its title from Shakespeare's 29th sonnet. It quotes Max Walter Svanberg, a Swedish surrealist, whose paintings and collages mostly depict women or androgynes in colorful, erotic metamorphosis. A sophisticated fairy art for exploring dreams and the subconscious. Also quoted are the artist Joseph Cornell, from the notes to one of his penny arcade constructions, and the English poet John Clare, who died in an insane asylum in 1864. You're traveling with a cricket's bone caravan.
What are the crickets saying?
Some are saying yes, and some are saying no.
In the mid-20th century, no anthology of American short fiction would have been complete without a Sherwood Anderson story. But as a white male Midwesterner, he's been somewhat eclipsed in our more inclusive literary canon. And yet Anderson prefigured and influenced not only major American novelists such as Faulkner and Hemingway, but experimental writers in Europe. Bertolt Brecht wrote a poem prompted by his admiration for Anderson's novel Poor White. Sherwood Anderson was born in Ohio in 1876 as the third son of a harness maker whose alcoholism left the family precarious. Young Sherwood earned the nickname Jobby because of the many odd jobs he took on to help support his mother and brothers. The demands placed on him in boyhood left him largely self-educated, and yet he was among the earliest writers to explore the new ideas of the turn of the century, including the psychoanalytical theories of Freud. His deceptive plainness of style allies him with the poetry of William Carlos Williams. The Book of the Grotesque is an unusual short short that introduces Anderson's 1919 story cycle, Winesburg, Ohio. The book is set in a middle America still haunted by the legacy of the Civil War. Frank Buzelich reads The Book of the Grotesque by Sherwood Anderson.
The writer, an old man with a white mustache, had some difficulty in getting into bed. The windows of the house in which he lived were high, and he wanted to look at the trees when he awoke in the morning. A carpenter came to fix the bed so that it would be on a level with the window. Quite a fuss was made about the matter. The carpenter, who had been a soldier in the Civil War, came into the writer's room and sat down to talk of building a platform for the purpose of raising the bed. The writer had cigars lying about, and the carpenter smoked. For a time, the two men talked of raising the bed, and then they talked of other things. The soldier got on the subject of the war. The writer had, in fact, led him to that subject. The carpenter had once been a prisoner in Andersonville Prison, and had lost a brother. The brother had died of starvation. Whenever the carpenter got upon that subject, he cried. He, like the old writer, had a white mustache. And when he cried, he puckered up his lips, and the mustache bobbed up and down. The weeping old man with the cigar in his mouth was ludicrous. The plan the writer had for the raising of his bed was forgotten, and later the carpenter did it in his own way, and the writer, who was just past 60, had to help himself with a chair when he went to bed at night. In his bed, the writer rolled over on his side and lay quite still. For years he had been beset with notions concerning his heart. He was a hard smoker, and his heart fluttered. The idea had got into his mind that he would sometime die unexpectedly, and always when he got into bed, he thought of that. It did not alarm him. The effect, in fact, was quite a special thing and not easily explained. It made him more alive there in bed than at any other time. Perfectly still he lay, and his body was old and not of much use anymore. But something inside him was altogether young. He was like a pregnant woman, only that the thing inside him was not a baby, but a youth. No, it wasn't a youth. It was a woman. Young and wearing a coat of mail like a knight. It is absurd, you see, to try to tell what was inside the old writer as he lay on his high bed and listened to the fluttering of his heart. The thing to get at is what the writer, or the young thing within the writer, was thinking about. The old writer, like all the people in the world, had got during his long life a great many notions in his head. He had once been quite handsome, and a number of women had been in love with him. Then, of course, he had known people, many people, known them in a peculiarly intimate way that was different from the way in which you and I know people. At least, that is what the writer thought. And the thought pleased him. Why quarrel with an old man concerning his thoughts? In the bed, the writer had a dream that was not a dream. As he grew somewhat sleepy but was still conscious, figures began to appear before his eyes. He imagined the young, indescribable thing within himself was driving a long procession of figures before his eyes. You see, the interest in all this lies in the figures that went before the eyes of the writer. They were all grotesques. All of the men and women the writer had ever known had become grotesques. The grotesques were not all horrible. Some were amusing. Some almost beautiful, and one, a woman all drawn out of shape, hurt the old man by her grotesqueness. When she passed, you made a noise like a small dog whimpering. Had you come into the room, you might have supposed the old man had unpleasant dreams or perhaps indigestion. For an hour, the procession of grotesques passed before the eyes of the old man, and then, although it was a painful thing to do, he crept out of bed and began to write. Some one of the grotesques had made a deep impression on his mind, and he wanted to describe it. At his desk, the writer worked for an hour. In the end, he wrote a book which he called The Book of the Grotesque. It was never published, but I saw it once, and it made an indelible impression on my mind. The book had one central thought that is very strange and has always remained with me. By remembering it, I've been able to understand many people and things that I was never able to understand before. The thought was involved, but a simple statement of it would be something like this, that in the beginning, when the world was young, there were a great many thoughts, but no such thing as a truth. Man made the truths himself, and each truth was a composite of a great many vague thoughts. All about in the world were truths, and they were all beautiful. The old man had listed hundreds of the truths in his book. I will not try to tell you all of them. There was the truth of virginity and the truth of passion, the truth of wealth and of poverty, of thrift and of profligacy, of carelessness and abandon. Hundreds and hundreds were the truths, and they were all beautiful. And then the people came along. Each, as he appeared, snatched up one of the truths, and some who were quite strong snatched up a dozen of them. It was the truths that made the people grotesques. The old man had quite an elaborate theory concerning the matter. It was his notion that the moment one of the people took one of the truths to himself, called it his truth, and tried to live his life by it, he became a grotesque, and the truth he embraced became a falsehood. You can see for yourself how the old man who had spent all his life writing and was filled with words would write hundreds of pages concerning this matter. The subject would become so big in his mind that he himself would be in danger of becoming grotesque. He didn't, I suppose, for the same reason that he never published the book. It was the young thing inside him that saved the old man. Concerning the old carpenter who had fixed the bed for the writer, I only mention him because he, like many of what are called very common people, became the nearest thing to what is understandable and lovable of all the grotesques in the writer's book.
The Cricket's Bone Caravan rolls on with the anthology To End Is to Begin. The modernist writer Juna Barnes once called herself the most famous unknown of the century. She was born along the Hudson River in 1892 to a polygamist family. Barnes received little formal education but challenged herself by reading voraciously and virtually memorizing the dictionary.
At 17, she was married to a man 3 times her age. He was the brother of her father's second wife. Influenced by her grandmother, a suffragist, journalist, and free love enthusiast, Barnes soon left for Greenwich Village to become a writer. Soon her journalism and drawings had appeared in almost every newspaper in the city. Her first collection of poems and drawings was The Book of Repulsive Women. Published in 1915, her descriptions of sex between women escaped prosecution under censorship statutes of the time, perhaps because the guardians of public morality didn't understand what Barnes was talking about. After success in the village theater scene, Juna Barnes moved to Paris. She became one of the most enigmatic and fearless of the American expatriate modernists, inhabiting the Paris of the 1920s and 30s. During this time, she wrote her most famous work, the lesbian novel Nightwood. Nightwood problematizes anti-Semitism and anticipates the Holocaust's community of victims in its cast of Jews, gay men, lesbians, transvestites, gypsies, people of color, and circus performers. T.S. Eliot observed in the novel a quality of horror and doom very nearly related to that of Elizabethan tragedy. By 1939, Barnes had become alcoholic and suicidal. She returned to New York and eked out an existence. She wrote little and was largely supported by the socialite arts patron Peggy Guggenheim. Until her death in 1982, Barnes preferred to live as a recluse. Her neighbor, the poet E.E. Cummings, would occasionally check on her by shouting from his window, "Are you still alive, Juna?" The Juna Barnes short story you're about to hear was first published in the Little Review in 1918. It won the O. Henry Prize that year and was collected in the annual anthology Best American Short Stories. Influenced by Strindberg's play Miss Julie, the story reverses conventional male-female dominance in a frank depiction of economic dependency and relationships across class boundaries. Lauren Robert reads A Night Among the Horses by Juna Barnes.
Toward dusk, in the summer of the year, a man dressed in a frock coat and top hat and carrying a cane crept through the underbrush bordering the corral of the Buckler farm. As he moved, small twigs snapped, fell, and were silent. His knees were green from wounded shrubbery and grass, and his outspread hands tore unheeded plants. His wrists hurt him, and he rested from time to time, always caring for his hat and knotted yellow cane, blowing through his mustache. Dew had been falling, covering the twilight leaves like myriad faces, damp with the perspiration of the struggle for existence. And half a mile away, standing out against the darkness of the night, a grove of white birches shimmered like teeth in a skull. He heard the creaking of a gate, and then the splashing of late rain into the depths of a dark cistern. His heart ached with the nearness of the earth, the faint murmur of it moving upon itself, like a sleeper who turns to throw an arm about a beloved. A frog began moaning among the skunk cabbages, and John thrust his hand deep into his bosom. Something somnolent seemed to be here, and he wondered. It was like a deep, heavy, yet soft prison where, without sin, one may suffer intolerable punishment. Presently he went on, feeling his way. He reached a high plank fence, and sensing it with his fingers, he lay down, resting his head against the ground. He was tired. He wanted to sleep. But he searched for his hat and cane and straightened out his coat beneath him before he turned his eyes to the stars. And now he could not sleep, and wondered why he had thought of it. Something quick was moving the earth. It seemed to live, to shake with sudden immensity. He heard a dog barking, and the dim light from a farm window kept winking as the trees swung against its square of light. The odor of daisies came to him, and the assuring, powerful smell of the stables. He opened his mouth and drew in his mustache. A faint tumult had begun. A tremor ran under the length of his body and trembled off into the earth like a shudder of joy, died down, and repeated itself. And presently he began to tremble, answering, throwing out his hands, curling them up weakly, as if the earth were withholding something precious, necessary. His hat fell off, striking a log with a dull, hollow sound, and he pressed his red mustache against the grass, weeping. Again he heard it, felt it. 100 hoofs beat upon the earth, and he knew the horses had gone wild in the corral on the other side of the fence. For animals greet the summer, striking the earth as friends strike the back of friends. He knew, he understood, a hail to summer, to life, to death. He drew himself against the bars, pressing his eyes under them, peering, waiting. He heard them coming up across the heavy turf, rounding the curve in the willow road. He opened his eyes and closed them again. The soft, menacing sound deepened, as heat deepens, strikes through the skin into the very flesh. Head on, with long legs rising, falling, rising again, striking the ground insanely, like needles taking terrible, impossible, and purposeless stitches. He saw their bellies, fawn-colored, pitching from side to side, flashing by, straining the fence. And he rose up on his feet and silently, swiftly, fled on beside them. Something delirious, hysterical, came over him, and he fell. Blood trickled into his eyes, down from his forehead. It had a fine feeling for a moment, like a mane, like that roan mare's mane that had passed him, red and long and splendid. He lifted his hand and closed his eyes once more, but the soft pounding did not cease, though now, in his sitting position, it only jogged him imperceptibly, as a child on a knee. It seemed to him that he was smothering, and he felt along the side of his face, as he had done in his youth, when they had put a cap on him that was too large. Twining green things, moist with earth blood, crept over his fingers. The hot, impatient leaves pressed in, and the green of the matted grass was deathly thick. He had heard about the freeness of nature, thought it was so, and it was not so. A trailing ground pine had torn up small blades in its journey across the hill, and a vine, wrist thick, twisted about a pale oak, hideously, gloriously killing it, dragging it into dust. A wax Patrick pipe leaned against his neck, staring with black eyes, and John opened his mouth, running his tongue across his lips, snapping it off, sighing. Move as he would, the grass was always under him, and the crackling of last autumn's leaves and last summer's twigs, minute dead of the infinite greatness, troubled him. Something portentous seemed connected with the patient noises about him. An acorn dropped, striking a thin, fine powder out of a frail oak pod. He took it up, tossing it. He had never liked to see things fall. He sat up, with the dim thunder of the horses far off, but quickening his heart. He went over the scene he had with Frieda Buckler, back there in the house. The long, quivering spears of pot grass standing by the window as she walked up and down, pulling at them, talking to him. Small, with cunning, fiery eyes and a pink and pointed chin. A daughter of a mother who had known too many admirers in her youth. A woman with an ample lap on which she held a Persian kitten or a trifle of fruit. Bounty, avarice, desire, intelligence, both of them had always what they wanted. He blew down his mustache again, thinking of Frieda in her flowing yellow veil that he had called ridiculous. She had not been angry. He was nothing but a stable boy then. It was the way with those small, intriguing women
whose nostrils were made delicate through the pain of many generations, that they might quiver whenever they caught a whiff of the stables. As near as they can get to the earth, he had said. And was Frida angry? She stroked his arm, always softly, looking away, an inner bitterness drawing down her mouth. She said, walking up and down quickly, looking ridiculously small, I am always gentle, John, frowning, trailing her veil, thrusting out her chin. He answered, I liked it better where I was. Horses, she said, showing sharp teeth, are nothing for a man with your bile, poi boy, curry comber, smelling of saddle soap. Lovely. She shriveled up her nose, touching his arm. Yes, but better things I will show you. You shall be a gentleman. Fine clothes. You will like them. They feel nice. And laughing, she turned on one high heel, sitting down. I like horses. They make people better. You are amusing, intelligent. You will see. A lackey, he returned passionately, throwing up his arm. What is there in this for you? What are you trying to do to me? The family. Askance, perhaps. I don't know. He sat down pondering. He was getting used to it, or thought he was, all but his wordy remonstrances. He knew better when thinking of his horses, realizing that when he should have married this small, unpleasant, and clever woman, he would know them no more. It was a game between them, which was the shrewder, which would win out. He, boy of ill breeding, grown from the gutter, fancied by this woman because he had called her ridiculous, or for some other reason that he would never know. This kind of person never tells the truth, and this, more than most things, troubled him. Was he a thing to be played with, debased into something better than he was, than he knew? Partly because he was proud of himself in the costume of a groom, partly because he was timid. He desired to get away, to go back to the stables. He walked up to the mirrors, as if about to challenge them, peering in. He knew he would look absurd, and then knew, with shame, that he looked splendidly better than most of the gentlemen that Frida Buckler knew. He hated himself. A man who had grown out of the city streets, a fine common thing. She saw him looking into the mirrors, one after the other, and drew her mouth down. She got up, walking beside him in the end, between him and them, taking his arm. You shall enter the army. You shall rise to general, or lieutenant at least. And there are horses there, and the sound of stirrups. With that physique, you will be happy. Authority, you know, she said, shaking her chin, smiling. Very well, but a common soldier. As you like, afterward. Afterward? Well, very well, a common soldier. He sensed something strange in her voice, a sort of irony, and it took the patience out of him. I have always been common. I could commit crimes easily, gladly. I'd like to. She looked away. That's natural, she said faintly. It's an instinct all strong men have. She knew what was troubling him, thwarted instincts, common, beautiful instincts that he was being robbed of. He wanted to do something final to prove his lower order. Caught himself making faces, idiot faces. And she laughed. If only your ears stuck out, chin receded, she said. You might look degenerate, common. But as it is... And he would creep away in hat, coat, and cane to peer at his horses, never daring to go in near them. Sometimes, when he wanted to weep, he would smear one glove with harness grease, but the other one he held behind his back, pretending one was enough to prove his revolt. She would torment him with vases, books, pictures, making a fool of him gently, persistently, making him doubt by cruel means the means of objects he was not used to, eternally taking him out of his sphere. "We have the best collection of miniatures," she would say, with one knee on a low ottoman, bringing them out in her small palm. "Here, look." He would put his hands behind him. She was a great woman, Lucretia Borgia. "Do you know history?" She put it back again because he did not answer, letting his mind, a curious one, torment itself. "You love things very much, don't you?" she would question, because she knew that he had a passion for one thing only. She kept placing new ladders beneath his feet, only to saw them off at the next rung, making him nothing more than a nervous, irritable experiment. He was uneasy, like one given food to smell and not to taste. And for a while, he had not wanted to taste. And then curiosity began, and he wanted to. And he also wanted to escape. And he could do neither. Well, after he had married her, what then? Satisfy her whim? And where would he be? He would be nothing, neither what he had been nor what other people were. This seemed to him, at times, her wish, a sort of place between lying down and standing up, a cramped position, a slow death, a curious woman. This same evening, he had looked at her attentively for the first time. Her hair was rather pretty, though too mousy, yet just in the nape of the neck, where it met the lawn of the collar, it was very attractive. She walked well for a little woman, too. Sometimes she would pretend to be lively, would run a little, catch herself at it, as if she had not intended to do it, and calm down once more. Or, creeping up to him, stroking his arm, talking to him, she would walk beside him, softly, slowly, that he might not step out, that he would have to crawl across the carpet. Once he had thought of trying her with honesty, with the truth of the situation. Perhaps she would give him an honest answer. And he had tried. "Now, Miss Frieda, just a word. What are you trying to do? What is it you want? What is there in me that can interest you? I want you to tell me. I want to know. I've got to ask someone, and I haven't anyone to ask but you." And for a moment, she almost relented, only to discover that she could not if she had wished. She did not know always what she meant herself. "I'll tell you," she said, hoping that this somehow might lead her into the truth, for herself, if not for him, but it did not. "You are a little nervous. You'll get used to it. You'll even grow to like it. Be patient. You'll learn soon enough that there is nothing in the world so agreeable as climbing, changing." "Well," he said, trying to read her, "and then?" "Well, that's all. You will regret the stables in the end. That's all." Her nostrils quivered. A light came into her eyes, a desire to defy, to be defied. And then, on this last night, he had done something terrible. He had made a blunder. There had been a party. The guests, a lot of them, were mostly drunk or touched with drink, and he, too, had too much. He remembered having thrown his arms about a tall woman, gowned in black, with loose shoulder straps, dragging her through a dance. He had even sung a bit of a song, madly, wildly, horribly. And suddenly, he had been brought up sharp by the fact that no one thought his behavior strange, that no one thought him presumptuous. Frieda's mother had not even moved or dropped the kitten from her lap where it sat, its loud, resolute purr shaking the satin of her gown. And he felt that Frieda had got him where she wanted him, between two rungs. Going directly up to her, he said, "You are ridiculous," and twirled his mustache, spitting into the garden. And he knew nothing about what happened until he found himself in the shrubbery, crawling toward the corral, through the dusk and the dampness of the leaves, carrying his cane, making sure of his hat, looking up at the stars. And now he knew why he had come. He was with his horses again. His eyes, pressed against the bars, stared in. The black stallion in the lead had been his special pet, a rough animal but kindly, knowing. And here they were once more, tearing up the grass, galloping about in the night, like a ballroom full of real people, people who wanted to do things, who did what they wanted to do. He began to crawl through the bars slowly, deftly, and when halfway through, he paused, thinking. Presently, he went on again, and drawing himself into the corral, his hat and cane thrown in before him, he lay there, mouth to the grass. They were still running, but less madly. One of them had gone up the willow road, leading into farther pasture, in a flare of dust, through which it looked immense and faint. On the top of the hill, three or four of the horses were standing, testing the weather. He would mount one, he would ride away, he would escape. And his horses, the things he knew, would be his escape. Bareback, he thought, would be like the days when he had taken what he could from the rush of the streets. Joy, exhilaration, life, and he was not afraid. He wanted to stand up, to cry aloud. And he saw 10 or 12 of them rounding the curve. And he did stand up. They did not seem to know him, did not seem to know what to make of him. And he stared at them, wondering. He did not think of his white shirt front, his sudden arising, the darkness, their excitement. Surely they would know in a moment more. Wheeling, flaring their wet nostrils, throwing up their manes, striking the earth in a quandary, they came on, whinnied faintly, and he knew what it was to be afraid. He had never been afraid, and he went down on his knees. With a new horror in his heart, he damned them. He turned his eyes up, but he could not open them. He thought rapidly, calling on Frida in his heart, speaking tenderly, promising. A flare of heat passed his throat and descended into his bosom. I want to live. I can do it. Damn it. I can do it. I can forge ahead, make my mark. He forgot where he was for a moment and found new pleasure in this spoken admission, this new rebellion. He moved with the faint shaking of the earth like a child on a woman's lap. The upbraided hoofs of the first horse missed him, but the second did not. And presently the horses drew apart, nibbling here and there, switching their tails, avoiding a patch of tall grass.
We close today with North Point North by John Cady, the title poem of his collection published in 2002 by HarperCollins. Regretfully, we've abridged the poem for broadcast. Cady teaches and publishes philosophy, but he thinks of his poetry as music, in terms of movements and sounds, and the way it flows.
In these I find my calling, in the shower, in the mirror, in unconscious hours spent staring at a screen, at artifacts complete unto themselves. I think of them as self-sufficient worlds where I can sojourn for a while, then wake to find the clouds dispersing and the sidewalk steaming with the rain that must have fallen while I stayed inside. The sun is shining, and the quiet doubts are answered with more doubts, for as the years begin to mirror one another and the diary in the brain implodes, what filters through the theories on the page is a kind of settledness, an equilibrium between the life I have and what time seemed to hold. These rooms, these poems, these ordinary streets that spring to life each summer in an intricate construction, blending failed hopes and present happiness, which from the outside seems like self-deception. There is no end to these reflections, to their measured music with its dying fall, wherein the heart and what it seeks are reconciled. I live them, and as though in gratitude they shape my days from morning with its sweetest smile until the hour when sleep blows out the candle. Between, the present falls away, and for a while the old romance resumes, familiar but unrecognized. An undiscovered place, concealed within the confines of this room, that seems at once a form of feeling and a state of grace, prepared for me, written in my name, against the time when time is finally merged, these commonplace surroundings with what lies behind the veil, leaving behind at least a version of the truth, composed of what I felt and what I saw outside my window on a summer morning, melding sound and sense, a music and a mood, together in a hesitant embrace that makes them equal at the end.
There may be nothing for a poem to change but an atmosphere. Conventional or strange, its meaning is enclosed by the perception, better by the misperception, of what time held and what the future knew, which is to say this very moment. And yet the promise of a distant purpose is what makes each moment new. There may be nothing for the soul to say in its defense, except to describe the way it came to find itself at the impasse. Morning reveals in the glass the road that led away from home to here, that began in wonderment and hope, but that ended in the long slope down to loneliness and the fear of fear. The casuistry is all in the event, contingent on what someone might have meant or might still mean. What feels most frightening is the thought that when the lightning has subsided and the clearing sky appears at last above the stage to mark the only end of age, that God, that distant and unseeing eye, would see that none of this had ever been, that none of it, apparent or unseen, was ever real. And all the private words which seemed to fill the air like birds exploding from the brush were merely sounds without significance or sense, inert and dead beneath the dense expanse of the earth in its impassive rounds. There may be no rejoinder to that thought. There may be nothing that one could have sought that might have lent the search significance or even a kind of coherence. Perhaps, yet closer to me than the grandeur of the vast and the uncreated, is the calm of this belated moment in its transitory splendor.
At the end of the remake of The Thing, Kurt Russell and one other guy are all that's left of what had been a crew of an Antarctic outpost. Some horrifying presence, some protean thing, establishes itself inside the person of an ordinary man and then, without warning, erupts in devastation. The two survivors eye each other slowly, neither knowing whether one of them still holds the horror. "What do we do now?" the second asks, and Russell says, "Let's see what happens." And the movie ends. Horror is too strong, but substitute the fear I spoke about before, and the scene is apt. I don't know, as no one really knows, what might lie waiting in the years to come, but sometimes when the question touches me, I feel afraid. Not of age, but an age that seems a prolongation of this afternoon, that looks ahead, that looks instead into itself. This is the fear that draws me back inside, that this is all there is, that what I hold so easily will vanish soon, and nothing like it will be given me again. The days will linger, and the nights rehearse themselves until the secret of my life has finally emerged, not in devastation, but in a long decline that leads at least as surely to a single end. And then I turn away and see the sky that soars above the streets of North Point North, reducing everyone to anonymity, an anonymity in which I find a kind of possibility, a kind of freedom as the world, the only world, rolls on its way, oblivious to anything I might say or that might happen in a poem. A poem can seize and hold a moment fast, yet it can limit what there is to feel and stake a distance from the world. The neighborhood around me wakes each day to lives no different than my own, lives harboring the same ambitions and regrets, but living on the humbler stuff of happiness. The disappointments come and go. What stays is part of an abiding presence, human and serene. The houses wait unquestioning in the light of an approaching summer evening, while a vast contentment answers from the air. I think I know where this is going to end, but still my pleasure is to wait. Not wait, perhaps, for anything within, but for what lies outside. Let's see what happens.
You have been listening to the anthology, To End is to Begin. Anthology is a production of Loose Lit Media for WFIU in Bloomington, Indiana. The voices from the Cricket's Bone Caravan were
Tony Brewer,
Frank Buzelich,
Berkeley Going,
Joan Hawkins,
Phil Casper,
Aaron Livingston,
Michael Perry,
Patsy Ron,
Renee Reed,
Lauren Robert,
Sarah Torbeck,
and Cynthia Wolf.
I'm Heather Perry. Anthology is produced, written, and edited by Cynthia Wolf. Our theme music is Calm by Ciro Baptista from his album Blue Fly, released in 2016 by Zadig. Sound effects from freesound.org. Recognize this week's cricket quote?
What are the crickets saying?
Some are saying yes, and some are saying no.
If you know the source, tweet us at cricketsbone. Or email us at looselit, one word, lowercase, at gmail.com. And join the caravan next time for the first in a two-part anthology, Askew Gardens, with fiction and poetry by Virginia Woolf, Catherine Mansfield, Alberto Ruiz Sanchez, Rita Dove, and more. For Anthology, this is Heather Perry. Thanks for listening.